What's up, everybody? Welcome to We Have Cool Friends, the cool show. We interview our cool friends about the cool things they're doing. I'm Greg, that's Nick, and these are our cool friends, David and Ryan. How are you, gentlemen?
Hey, pretty good. How you doing?
I can't complain. I've been listening to this brand new podcast, The Stuff Dreams Are Made Of. You, David and Ryan, host it. Congratulations. You just launched it today as we record this.
Yeah, thanks. First two episodes went live some point today, somewhere.
Somewhere on the internet, there's a portal of podcasts.
I'm in charge of the tech side, so yes, they went live somewhere at some point.
Excellent. You guys are killing it. I appreciate it. Episode one, you're like, yeah, you know, we started in Instagram. You can find us at Props Podcast. We're gonna upload the things we talk about, so you can follow along. And I went and did it, and there's like no props up yet. I'm like, this is the kind of funny kind of podcast energy. Yes. I know.
That email was at 2 a.m. last night. Was we need pictures? But anyway,
yeah. That's happening later today. So keep following.
So of course you guys just started this podcast. It's about movie memorabilia and you guys collecting and going through all that. We're going to talk about that for sure. But then also I like to give everybody the elevator pitch for who you are in case they've never heard of you. Ryan, who are you?
I'm an adult male. I'm a screenwriter by trade, a collector sort of by night and by, you know, no choice of my own. It's just something that happened to me. And I've just been obsessed with movies my entire life, and they've bled into my personal life, my professional life, my hobby life. It's everything. I don't really know how I would identify myself if it wasn't for film. So
when you say screenwriter, what have you been working on?
So the current project, the only thing that I'm working on at the moment is called House of the Dragon. It's the prequel series, or the, as George R. R. Martin prefers, successor series to Game of Thrones, the original Game of Thrones.
Wait, so absolutely no pressure on you.
Wait, you're working on a Game of Thrones prequel?
Dave, I've been waiting for the time to tell you. It didn't seem right, but you know, we like to surprise
each
other.
How are you doing that? How are you doing that in Los Angeles here?
I'm actually in London.
What?
Yeah. Well, we haven't seen each other since 2018, so you know, how would you know? But that's keeping me very, very busy at the moment.
And you thought, why not in the middle of all that start a podcast? In a global pandemic, being in London separated from David, working on the successor to Game of Thrones, why not start a podcast?
Exactly. You've been talking to my wife, haven't you?
Yes. And then David, how do you describe yourself? How do people know you?
I don't know how I describe myself, but I think my tombstone will simply read, "He wrote the Bizarro Jerry on Seinfeld." So that'll be the sum of my my work on Earth. But
I was prominently
a long time comedy writer, director, Saturday Night Live, Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, last couple of seasons of Veep.
Clerks, comedy, the animated series.
Hell
Clerks,
yes.
The animated series. Some movies that are not quite as good. Although Eurotrip, that's not Euro a bad trip. One.
I was going to say, how dare you, sir? How dare you? we're talking, Scotty doesn't know here, Eurotrip. Let's go. Come
now
on.
Now I know
son.
Exactly how old you are. Go on.
Yeah.
Well, this is, I mean, we're going to get
into it. Is that a litmus test for your work? Oh, if people look back fondly on Eurotrip, they're like, yeah, you were born in the 80s.
Obviously, we're going to talk more about the podcast. We're going to talk about your careers and everything else. But that was the moment for me with you, David, where it was that our friend Fareed from Rooster Teeth that hit us up and was like, hey, we're helping these guys launch a podcast. We'd love to have them collab with you. They're definitely right up here in Nick's alleys. And I was like, all right. And I clicked on your profile pic on Google and I was like, oh my fucking God. Like, it's the dude from Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back who was drinking coffee. And like, this is such a deep cut for Kind of Funny fans, because on Kind of Funny's In Review for Kevin Smith, I was like, look at, in this frame, you see this guy drinking two cups of coffee. And that's because they cut out a scene where he needed to pee. But if the extra credit is, look for that guy in a future episode or a future episode of In Review, a future movie or whatever. Because I remember you being and having all these stories from Clerks, the animated series, because I am such a Kevin Smith fan.
It was, I did the first one, you know, all those years ago, and it was really fun. And we did the extra scene, which, by the way, I was brilliant in. They cut it, but I was brilliant.
It's offensive.
I believe the joke, which really always made me laugh, was, It was a guy who really had to, you see him drinking a lot of coffee just in front of the bus drinking, and then you're on the bus and they're getting high in the bathroom, and I'm like, I gotta go in the bathroom. I've got a kidney problem. I've got three kidneys. None of them work. That was the line I remember really loving. But the scene got cut and probably should have. And then a gazillion years later, when he was making the new movie, he was like, would you ever fly yourself to New Orleans to be basically coffee drinking guy extra? And I was like, yeah, what day do you need me there? So yeah.
That's commitment right there. That is a commitment to a good joke.
So let's start with the podcast. I think that's the most new and noteworthy section, as it would be on iTunes and podcast services, right? What is the stuff Dreams Are Made Of?
Well, it's a podcast all about collecting. I mean, we're really, you know, there's been a couple of these things around, but nothing that's really explored what it means to be a collector. You know, Dave and I have been, doing this for, you know, the greater part of our adult lives, both of us. That's actually how we met. We happen to have the same job, but we actually met as collectors. And we really wanted to bring people into the experience of being a collector and what that is like and what we go through and the things that we think about and the things that we get excited about or afraid of, or, you know, when we think about, you know, we get a piece that needs restoration, how do you deal with that? So the first season of the podcast is really meant to introduce people into the world of movie memorabilia collecting. We mean it to be like an introductory course to it. So by the end of the 12 episodes, you have basically an education in what it means to be a movie memorabilia collector.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, it's kind of the live podcast or whatever of the conversations we have. I mean, this is what we talk about, Ryan and I, regularly. And so it just sort of seemed easier to just record it, basically. And it's an opportunity, I think, especially because it's a podcast and not, you know, a TV show somewhere where they want it to be, oh, what's it worth? And what's this worth? And, you know, that just very sort of simplistic, where we can spend, you know, a half an hour telling like a crazy story about how I had to hire a private investigator to help me find a prop that no one else except in podcasting would give you the time to tell that story.
Wait, what was the prop? What did you need the PI for?
Okay, so you may not know these, but okay, do you guys remember the Burger King glasses for Star Wars when I was a kid, but maybe they were still around, like on the internet later Googling on for it. You guys?
Is that No, I don't remember these.
Okay, so they had these glasses with like Luke Skywalker, Chewbacca, and Han Solo. They were four glasses.
Oh, you mean like drinking glasses?
Yeah, drinking glasses.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. I thought for some reason I went eyeglasses. I was like, that's weird.
Sorry.
Burger King Day.
Coca-Cola, yeah, Coca-Cola's new eyeglasses line. It was a bit of a disaster for the company, but they recovered when they invented soda. No, and
these are awesome.
They gave these glasses out once a week, and there were these glasses, and then there was also like a poster, a mini poster that you could get at Burger King or in other parts of the country, Burger Chef. And the art were these just gorgeous paintings that George Lucas, an artist that he picked, of these sort of four subject matters. And I always had these posters. I had the glasses. I was obsessed with them. And a couple of years ago, I began sort of internet deep diving, trying to find the artist. I kind of tracked him down through a son. He was deceased. They didn't have the pieces, blah, 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 blah. Eventually, I found the son of a guy that worked for Coca-Cola that had them, but I only knew like his first name and his last initial and Coca-Cola and whatever. And basically I had all these little bits and pieces of information, and I ended up hiring a mom at my kid's preschool who was a private investigator to basically, here's what I know about this guy. Can you find him? And a couple of weeks went by and she calls me one day and is like, here's his phone number. He's waiting for your call. He thought this was really funny. And those pieces are hanging on my wall. And that's what this show is about. That's what our podcast is about.
There's two shocking things for me on that one. One, that it was that easy and that's awesome. And this is that you have this much time on your very busy schedule to do this stuff.
I would have tracked it down.
I think the more shocking thing is that in the 80s, Burger King thought it was okay to just give away glass to people. These are actual glasses that I'm looking at right now. If I'm looking at the right thing.
They are fantastic. Yeah. They did four for each of the movies. So there's 12 of them. There's Star Wars, Empire, and Jedi. And they're gorgeous. And honestly, I have a set I drink out of to this day. Although a couple of them have broken. But anyway, yeah.
That finally gives context. I remember when in Family Guy, when Peter Griffin had the collection of the Star Wars Burger King glasses. Because yes. When you said glasses, I thought glasses too. Like, they're giving out eyeglasses?
Or 3D glasses, yeah.
No, 3D glasses, that would work too. Yeah,
that's amazing. And so this is obviously just for you guys. I mean, this is a very time-consuming thing sometimes.
More than we realized, I think.
Like most good hobbies, I suppose. Built straight out of passion and built mostly to annoy your significant others.
But in a really great way, and I will tell you, and this goes back, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, sometimes you're working harder than other times, but like, I can remember, you know, back in the day, like working on Seinfeld, where we were working, you know, we were doing seven days a week, just nonstop, just rolling one week into another. And it's collecting that, like, I'd be in a meeting and I'd come out and maybe, and I am now truly dating myself, there'd be a fax or or a message on a phone, like, you know, pinned to my door, like, call this guy. And in some ways, that little 2-minute break from the nonstop work, by the way, a great job, a really fun thing. It's not like Seinfeld was torture, but that little break of the hobby was like a little ray of sunshine in my sort of coal mine, if you will. And then obviously when you're not working so hard, it expands, you know, it's like a gas. It expands to fill all available sort of time and space. So, yeah.
Was there gateway drug for this? Was there like the one thing that you said, oh, that's interesting, I got to get that thing. And then that
took it all out for you. I've always collected stuff, and I definitely at the time was collecting a lot of, I was rebuying all the toys of my youth. So I was buying in particular all the Star Wars action figures, like mint in package with like even the hole unpunched
on the card. Yeah.
That's an obsessive
perfect,
level.
Perfect. But there were X number of figures, and one day you kind of go, oh, I've got them all. You know what I mean? And in the back of a toy magazine at the time, there was an ad for an auction. And when those pictures go live on our Instagram, I've got a copy of the ad from the back of the magazine that we're going to put up. And basically,
we're faxing them over right now.
Coming by carrier pigeon. It was basically an ad for a stormtrooper, like a phone auction for a stormtrooper. And I bought it, and I was hooked. I mean, that was honestly it. It was like the next step. I had the toys. Now I've got something from the movie.
It was interesting listening to the podcast because you guys start in and you know, here it is. This is what the show is going to be. We're talking about the stuff dreams are made of. Here's this line from the Maltese Falcon. Like, we're full-blown movie dorks. And I was immediately like, oh, okay. Like, this is going to be cool to get the background for what the show is going to be. But I don't think I have that for movies. And then Ryan, you set it up so well when you were like, oh yeah, but you know, it started with me in comic books, and there's a bunch in my mom's attic that she loved me. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like me and my dad, where my long boxes right are up there. My long boxes not only of comics, but of mint on card, Superman, Man of Steel, JLA action figures that I bought duplicates of so I could open one and put one in perfect. Like, that is all there. And so then to hear you guys start talking about the memorabilia, that's when I was like, oh, like, I am going to be into this. And it is, I am on that teeter-tottery slope of one day just buying a movie prop proton pack rather than my movie accurate proton pack and my movie accurate suit, right?
Yeah, I was gonna say, Greg, see, they're buying stuff that's worth something. You're just buying every Ecto-1 you can find.
You know what? If they bring me happiness, Nick, if the Ecto-1s bring me happiness, they bring me happiness. All right, get out of me, get away from
me. It's whatever it means to you. That's the value of it. No, I mean, you know, I started in comic books. I collected baseball cards. You know, we all have a very similar story. A lot of people come from, you know, toy collecting and move over. I actually got very into replica props, you know, so it's sort of, you know, I never had a proton pack. It was actually something I always wanted.
Greg will give you one. He'll ship you one.
I'll sell you at a fair price.
We'll talk about it. But I, you know, I love that stuff. And I just, I'm not an engineer, but I've always loved cars and mechanical things and just the, you know, beauty of aesthetics and the way things are designed and, you know, in like Sid Mead designs and things like that. And I've always been really attracted to it. And I just loved, and even in the replica world, these beautifully kind of handmade pieces and how, like, you know, a replica of like Obi-Wan's lightsaber from A New Hope, and made from all of the exact off the shelf pieces that, you know, that were used to make it, like it was a British grenade from World War II, a piece of a sink. There's a valve from a Rolls-Royce plane engine that's in it that is so rare that they alone go for like $5,000 or $6,000 a piece, if just the valve, if you can find it, you know. And I just loved the sort of insanity that went into building that, and then you get this beautiful piece at the end of it. So for me, it was a much clearer bridge. It's sort of like you have a little money in your pocket and you're like, I want to act, this is great. I want to actually have something that was used in the film. And that was a quick bridge for me. And then, you know, I think I tell the story in the podcast. I bought this Viper helmet, one of the Battlestar helmets, when Ron Moore's series wrapped, Universal ran an auction. And I bid on and won one of the Viper helmets from the show. And it was all padded inside and it lit up. It had a power pack, so all the, you know, you could light up the face. And I was just like, I brought it home and I was just like, oh, this is very bad. Like, it's all over for me. And here we are, you know, 11 years later. And, you know, if I was in my office in Los Angeles, you'd see it's just surrounding me.
So is that where most of the stuff is kept, guys, in the office, or is there a spare bedroom somewhere in a house in LA that's just,
it sort of leaks out into, you know, as the years go by, you find it in every room of the house. I mean, I tried to keep it, you know, pretty relegated to my office, but yeah, there are pieces around, and then you get art pieces and things that are sort of more acceptable to hang in the common spaces
that are approved, that are wife approved.
Yeah, exactly.
You guys may enjoy this. My wife and I owned a condo when my wife and I got married. We lived in it for about a year, and then we moved out into a house a little bit before our first daughter was born. And I basically, we moved out, but I still own the condo, and the condo is now, the collection lives there.
Love it.
Yeah.
I love it. That's such an exorbitant expense for no reason.
To keep your other exorbitant expenses there.
But it's funny because my wife,
it's awesome. It's like, it's the greatest place in the world. It's so fun to walk through.
One of the things you talked about on the podcast that I really connected with, right, was the collector gene. And how you said in one of your children you saw it and the other you didn't see it. And then you also told this story of like you collecting just random golf balls on a trip where you're like, oh, this is a ridiculous, what, the Texas Book Depository gift shop.
It starts with like, isn't this funny? And then there's two and it's like, aren't they funny? And then it's three and it's like, it's starting to be a collection. And then it's like, stop it. Just stop it.
Yeah. And that's what I, you know, as Nick makes fun of me for my Ecto-1s that are, I have my smaller collection here on my desk. The more of them are at the office along with the Superman Funko Pops and everything else. What is it about collecting that speaks to people like you and me and Ryan as well, obviously?
Me, it's memories, right? It's like all nostalgia. You're buying a memory to me, especially with the movie memorabilia. You know, it's like, you know, movies are very intangible, and the things that we have, I think, give us this like kind of physical connection to, you know, to that. And look, you know, I mean, Dave and I have some stuff from modern things, but really, if you look at it, it's all the stuff from when we were kids. You know, happy times, happy memories. Yeah. That you know, the way you felt when you saw, you know, Keaton's Batman, 1989 Batman, the first time in the theater, yeah. And I, you know, I have a cowl, I have a bat cowl.
You have an actual cowl
from that movie, yeah. Wow. And it's great. I mean, I actually got it. I got it last year. The 30th anniversary was going on. One came available, and I was like, yeah, I need that. And it's just, I stare at it every day. I just like, I can't. If you showed 10-year-old me that, I would have just lost my mind. And I lost my mind as a, you know, as somewhat grown 41 year old adult. So does it it's great.
Does it become sort of like, this is the thing I would worry about, right? Okay, you get the cowl and then you watch the cowl, and then that rubber, you know, is it's at some point going to deteriorate to a degree that would just kill my anal retentiveness. I would have
we actually talk about, I mean, that's one of the things we actually talk about. And for example, with one of those cowls, you have to get it treated. You basically have to get it, for lack of a better word, treated or almost sealed, basically, because right. a lot of them, if you don't treat that thing right, yeah, it will turn to mushy dust. But, you know, that's, I guess, again, that sort of level of detail that we actually kind of can get into in sort of a fun way on the podcast. And so Ryan's is treated, although, like, I knew a guy years ago that had in the second movie in Batman Returns, remember those like discs that the Batmobile like shoots out like yeah. at the circus clowns, whatever? Mm. That's sort of made of almost like the same like rubbery material that's, you know, it's that's those sort of same things. And he had one and he had it in a case and, it, you know, and he walked by it every day. And I don't know when, you know, one day he walked by it and realized it had just sort of melted and Ooh. Kind of like, you know what I mean? And it was just, yeah. it was gone.
It was over, and, yeah.
But you can't, you know, again, these things are, you know, in the same way you would, you know, take a rare painting and not just hang it with the sun directly on it. You know, mm-hmm. that's some of the care and whatever that goes into these things.
There's a responsibility to it. I mean, with this in particular, it's really, the problem is more that the material that it was made out of kind of hardens and stiffens over time. And a lot of people just left them unsupported, or worse, put them on like a hat stand or something, like a single point of pressure, and they just kind of, they dry and then they stretch and gravity pulls them down. So mine is actually permanently mounted to Michael Keaton. That's awesome. So I have
he's
Michael
just
Keaton
in the condo right now.
Please let me out.
He loves being there. Don't believe anything else you hear.
Now, why you haven't seen him in a lot of films lately.
Yeah.
Correct. Yes. No, they cast him. So there were these like bust up life casts of Michael Keaton around. And there's a few people that use them to permanently mount these things on. So mine is like glued onto the thing and has been protected in places that were kind of, you know, coming apart a little, were fixed up and filled. And now, as long as I keep it out of sunlight and take care of it and keep it temperature controlled, it's going to be fine for many years to come, because it's not going to, gravity's not going to drag it apart.
So are there specific people that specialize in like restoration for these things, like there would, you know, yes. a classic car?
Yeah, yes. absolutely. And they same thing. They're much in demand. There's very few of them and they charge a lot. But yeah, so,
it's, do they do the same thing with like they just don't sometimes just don't show up for appointments because they can't?
I had a piece, and it's a guy I love. I won't say his name, but he had a piece of mine for like over a year, and there was nowhere else to go. So it was yeah. like, you know, finish that up, or I'll say finish that up again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Or I'll pay you more money. Yeah, I just have no choice. When you guys collect, though, do you think like the same way a classic car collector would, where you say, I'm just sort of, some of these pieces are so important that they're going to outlive me. I'm just sort of mm-hmm. shepherding them to the next person so that they can enjoy it.
I don't
absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure I'm actively thinking that. Like, I'm not like, oh,
you are now.
Yeah, but it's in the back of my mind that, you know, and sometimes with some of the pieces you have, you know, if you learn their history or the story, you know, some of them were like saved out of dumpsters because nobody valued this stuff. Nowadays, people sort of now, and because of podcasts, maybe like ours, people know that the stuff has value. There's a collectibles market. But in the 70s, you know, when you go back to those crew members and say like, you know, if you had a stormtrooper helmet, that would be worth X number of dollars. They can't believe it. That was the stupid movie with the weird American director. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. what Star Wars was to a lot of that British crew. So nobody cared. They were, you know, thrown around. Pieces were brought home, repainted green and given to a kid to play with for Halloween. You know, nobody cared. And so sometimes when you get a piece and the story is like it got rescued and a kid played with it and then you now have it, you do feel a little bit of a responsibility that like, you know, somehow luckily this didn't end up just in a garbage can like so many other pieces. So yeah, a little bit.
Ryan, you were going to say something there too. I don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, I don't think, you know, I think anytime you go and think of that you're sort of facing your own mortality, which, you know,
it was kind of a deep question for 9 o'clock in the morning. I apologize.
Nick wants to hurt you guys because his wife.
I just want you guys to know
anything.
We're all going
to
die probably sooner than we think.
But I a couple of years ago, I acquired one of Conan's steel hero Atlanteans from Conan the Barbarian from 1982. And you know, there's something about a sword and the fact that this thing weighs like 9 pounds.
I was gonna say, how heavy heavy is that thing?
And it's crazy. And that scene on the beach after he's rehabilitated and he's like swinging it around, sort of getting his
blowing back. His beautiful hair. Yeah.
It's amazing. Normally an actor would use the stunt one, so he would look cool doing it, but I've spent a lot of time looking at that scene. It's the steel hero. Arnold is swinging around a 9-pound like brick, basically like it's nothing. It's awesome.
They used to do like deadlifts with like 500 pounds and they'd squat those things and then walk them across the, I don't know if you've seen Pumping Iron, but
yes,
those guys were on a different level.
Many a time, but you know, there's something particular about when I got that where it was like, it was a sword and it just felt like an heirloom. And, you know, you hear these stories about these, you know, samurai swords that have, you know, were made, you know, a thousand years ago and have been meticulously passed down through a family line or passed through collectors, and everybody is kind of the caretaker taking it on. So I think when I got that one, I was sort of like, wow, this is, you know, this sort of ancient, you know, piece of beautiful, you know, kind of handmade engineering. And I sort of felt like, wow, I'm the caretaker until the next person comes along. Of course, I did tell my wife that I was to be buried in it, buried with it, like a Viking, clutched to my chest, pushed down to the river.
I'll be honest.
She said, I know where to get a great replica. You'll be fine.
I'll be honest with you. If I had that 89 cowl, for sure, Greg, if I die before you, I want you to come. And I just want to be, I want the whole outfit, because I'm pretty sure I'm roughly the same height as Michael Keaton.
I'm going to bury you in the Adam West outfit, whether you like it or not. So
I'll take it. Just make sure my nipples are hard.
Exactly.
Okay, I think, honestly.
In a similar vein to this question, do you guys like flip items? Do you get stuff and then sell it or trade it or whatever? Or is it like you're buying the stuff and then it's yours, you know, until the end of time kind of thing?
It happens, but I mean, I think we both kind of, you know, we're dragons about it. We sort of, you know, buy it and plan to, you know, keep it in the cave as long as we possibly can. It happens over time. Sometimes upgrades come around. You find something better. You have something that's not screen matched, and then you find something that is screen matched, and you want to make a move up. I tell a story in the podcast. I, you know, 9 years ago, I had a Stormtrooper helmet from Return of the Jedi. And when the Conan sword came around, I needed to raise cash immediately. It was like this once in a lifetime opportunity. There was a crew member that had it. I had to get it, and I needed to liquidate something. So I picked the helmet and then spent 9 years sort of being mocked by the prop gods, because I just figured, oh, I'll go. There's a lot of these. There were a lot of Stormtroopers. I'll get another one. It took 9 years, but I eventually got one back, and I got one from the first movie. So to me, that's an upgrade. So
sure.
You know, I don't consider that a flip, because I was improving my collection as I went along, but that's more what I think what happens for me. I mean, I don't know, Dave, do you feel
I was
going to
say, I don't know, I guess for me, when you say flip, I think of it as you bought it maybe in the first place for profit. And I've just really never really done that ever. I definitely, you know, or especially early in my collecting, I made mistakes. I bought things, and then later on, like we joke, I bought things, you know, I love Star Wars, and I bought a couple of things from the prequels, and, you know, a couple of years in was just like, why do I have anything from those movies? That's not
it's Jar Jar's Star Wars. Hands.
and I got rid of them at a loss, actually. So an anti-flip, but I just, you know, you get things and you go, why did I buy this? And that happens a lot early on. And there were definitely, early on, I was buying a lot of little smaller pieces instead of waiting for something good. Mm. And eventually, again, those things go. But, you know, sort of like Ryan, these large deals do happen. I did a big deal a couple of years ago. And again, the reasons were to get an incredible dream piece, which was an actual lightsaber from Return of the Jedi. It's basically, do you remember when at the beginning of the movie R2-D2 sort of fires the lightsaber to Luke so he can kill Jabba's people and whatever? So there is a real one that's made of metal, but there was also then basically a sort of a duplicate one that wasn't made of metal, that was sort of that was like, you know, molded and, you know, a cast version of it. And so that sort of showed up. So it's maybe not my perfect lightsaber, but, you know, how many lightsabers does anybody
else lightsaber.
Have? So yeah, exactly. And to make the deal happen, the person who had it was looking for some props for his collection. And I let go of one or two things. I let go of, I had a stunt Conan sword that I traded to another friend to get a hoverboard because this guy wanted a hoverboard. So I didn't even own the hoverboard, but I had the sword. So the sword went for the hoverboard. The hoverboard left me. I had a Steve Zissou outfit from, which is a more recent movie that I love. And I had to give up the Zissou. So, you know, again, these things happen and I miss everything I got rid of a little bit, but when I look at that lightsaber, I don't think about it. You know, that's the easiest way I can put it.
In the very specific example of this lightsaber, did you know ahead of time that this, like, oh, well, there's one metal one and then there's one rubber one, I'm just calling it, or, you know, prop one, as if the other one's the real one. You know what I mean? Did you know the history already? Were you already looking for that? Or is that something that somebody comes up on an auction site or in, I guess, your circle of friends?
It was actually a piece that I sort of, I remembered when it kind of got discovered and was sort of almost offered to me, but then not offered to me. And this other guy bought it who I knew. And oddly, also connected to this somewhere along the way, I had co-written a book a couple of years ago on called Star Wars Art, Ralph McQuarrie, which is basically about all of the conceptual art for the Star Wars movies that Ralph McQuarrie did. And I did that for Lucasfilm, and I did it with my with two other partners, Wade LaJoste and Brandon Allinger, both of whom are collectors. And we got to spend a whole bunch of time up in the Lucas archives, and we got to see stuff, and it was really fun, and pictures and stuff. And connected to this lightsaber was, I guess, was some pictures of it, like sort of verifying that this lightsaber was right. So when I missed out on it the first time, I knew exactly what it was. I was very sort of not mad, but I was like, God, I wish I'd gotten that. Didn't think twice about it because I thought it had gone into basically a collection where it was going to disappear forever. And then was sort of shocked a couple of years later when I guess the guy decided he didn't really have a Star Wars collection and was kind of collecting other things. And again, it wasn't an easy deal, but again, knowing he liked Back to the Future and didn't have a hoverboard and was looking for one. So I was able to, like, things I knew about him, I was able to offer.
You're playing on him.
It's like the first 20 minutes of Uncut Gems. You're just on the street making deals, borrowing someone's thing, selling it to someone else, and then selling it back to him. That's insane.
That movie did hit a little close to home.
Yeah,
I bet.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to pivot because I want to talk about how your love of movies and then obviously your careers plays into your love of movie memorabilia. But before you do that, let me tell you that this is We Have Cool Friends, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, each and every Tuesday, we come together to talk to some cool friends in our cool world about the cool things they're doing. If you like that, you can head over to patreon.com/kindoffunny, where you can get each and every episode ad-free. You can have a good time. You can support us. You can ride into the friend zone to ask the cool friends questions. You can have a great time, just like our Patreon producer, Mohammed is doing right now. Today, we're brought to you by Honey, so let's talk about them. This episode of We Have Cool Friends is brought to you by Honey. I don't even need to look at the ad copy. I mean, I will eventually because they'll get mad if I don't. But I use Honey all the time. What is Honey? It's a free add-on to your internet browser. You'll go to joinhoney.com/morning. I got to look that part of it up. And then you'll install Honey with like three clicks. And then it's a little H that I see. This is the camera. But right here is my internet browser. And I have a little Honey button there. And I click on it. And basically, I don't even need to click on it. I shouldn't say that yet because this is what you do later. What you do with it after you join it is when you're checking out online, there'll be a little, the Honey coin will drop down and say, do you want me to look for discounts? And you'll say, yes, you do. And it'll run all the different, you know, promo codes you can get on different websites. And then it'll find one that'll save you money. You can apply it. And then you go and you save money and it's great and it's free. But if you log in with your Gmail like I do, Honey will be up there and it'll keep track of stuff. And then it'll track your coins and points and all that jazz. So basically, as you go through it, you can, you know, start saving stuff up, and then you can spend the coins on, or the Honey points on gift cards, which I did for Amazon because I buy everything on Amazon. So that's what I've been talking about. Let's see what I said in the ad, that my ad that I made up off the top of my head, but they put in their own stuff. And they said, of course, it's a free browser extension that scours the internet for promo codes and automatically tests them while you're checking out. Get Honey on your computer for free in two easy clicks. Then when you're checking out it, on one of its over 30,000 supported sites, Honey pops up and all you have to do is say, apply coupons. It searches, you find the best one for your cart, boom. That's what I've done, that's what I do, that's why I do it. Honey has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. Honey supports all kinds of retailers, from tech giants to gaming sites to fashion brands to even food delivery. It's simple. If you have a computer, Honey should be on it. It's free and it works with whatever browser you use. You can get Honey for free today at joinhoney.com/morning. That's joinhoney.com/morning. So they know we sent you. Thanks, Honey, for supporting today's episode. All right. So when you're going, especially with you guys saying you have the same kind of job. You're both writers, obviously producers. You're in LA usually if you're not making some Game of Thrones thing. You're never walking around, you're going to these swap meets and you're, you know, in the same circles. In those circles, is it people like you that, like, are you finding that the people who are most obsessed with movie memorabilia are in the movie entertainment industry?
No, not yeah. in the least. There definitely are people you meet, and maybe you have on that initial meeting a little more to talk to them, you know, like, oh, you worked on blank. But that's kind of what's interesting. I mean, I've just, you know, just all walks of life. I mean, it sounds silly, but it is really true. And you meet people. Some people, this is all they do. Some people, you know, again, everything, doctors, scientists, you know, computer guys, you know, guys, by the way, guys with jobs where you just go, oh my God, how do you do this? This is not the cheapest hobby, but you know, they hustle and they
prioritize, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then for you, Ryan, when did you know, and I'm talking like for career, that entertainment was going to be what it was going to be for you?
I was a weird kid that knew at 12 I wanted to be a writer. I mean, I thought I wanted to be a novelist. I grew up in the 80s, and this is before all this stuff was kind of, you know, open source on the internet, that, you know, how movies are made and everything. Sure. And I went to this magnet school in for high school, and there was they tried to bring a lot of teachers and professors that had worked in industry instead of teachers, you know, instead of a chemistry teacher, you would have an actual chemist teaching in chemistry.
Sure.
Works sometimes better than others.
That sounds like it could be a crapshoot.
Yes, particularly with chemistry. But our humanities teacher was a guy that actually worked in development. He like worked at Disney and story development and things like that, and just had this passion for teaching and wanted to teach kids basically, you know, writing and drama and things like that. So he taught us the three-act structure, the Sid Field or the Joseph Campbell structure. And he taught us it against Star Wars A New Hope, and showed us how that's like, you know, amazing. Luke is the unwilling protagonist and Obi-Wan is the gatekeeper, the old wizard who gives him a magic sword before he crosses the barrier. And I was just like, I was 14, 15 years old, and I was just sitting there and I was just like, what is happening? And I realized that movies, which I very much loved, were written things. It wasn't just like George Lucas going out there and, you know, telling these guys to go do a bunch of things, which sounds silly now, but, you know, back in the day, it was not something that I realized that there was a specific job for a movie writer. And at that moment, it was just like, I want to be a film screenwriter. That's it. That's all I want to do. And I just, you know, pursued it to, you know, points of kind of, you know, mental oblivion.
I just wanted to say I went to a really good high school also.
I heard that your high school is slightly louder than his high school, though, and that's the important thing. That's a
I didn't
joke
say it
for
was
the
good,
pre-show.
Dave. I just said it was a magnet.
It doesn't exist. Yeah. The mic check that doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah. Sorry, about
David.
That.
Similar question for you. How did you know that you wanted to go into entertainment and comedy writing?
You know, it's funny. I was actually we do nothing here at this house now, except the only time we ever leave is to walk the dog. And sure. I was walking the dog with my daughter, and we were sort of talking about, I don't know, she was just kind of talking about what she wanted to do. We sort of got to the entertainment industry a little bit. And I was sort of saying, when I was a kid, this didn't seem like something people did. Like I was a huge fan. I definitely read a lot, and I read about writers and shows and things and movies and how stuff was made, but it just seemed like other. And so, you know, I was definitely like, oh, maybe I'll be a lawyer. And I, in the back of my mind, was my secret dream, which may be the most perverse joke ever told, maybe I could be an entertainment lawyer. Like that was my ideal. Like, wouldn't it be great to deal with boring contracts if they were about the entertainment industry? But when I got to college, and again, I was a huge movie nerd, comedy nerd, all these things. When I got to college, I got involved in writing. I joined and became a member of the Harvard Lampoon, and really just got
into
comedy writing. And very quickly, I found myself like the summer between my junior and senior year working on my first TV show for Comedy Central. And there was just, I went through the motions of a lot of like telling my parents, like, I'm going to do corporate recruiting and, you know, here's my resume. But I was just, I knew I had to at least try the comedy writing thing. And I just sort of, there was no way I wasn't going to do that, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I remember growing up and it was the same, a similar thing where it just wasn't as saturated just outwardly as it is right now, where people are having careers playing games online, they're having careers in all facets of entertainment. And so I think parents are a little bit more aware that kids can make money in these non-traditional routes. But for me, growing up in the 80s, it didn't dawn on me that you could be a filmmaker until I watched like Clerks, movies like that, sure. or a Tarantino film where you're like, wait a minute, this dude used to work at a video store and now he's making Reservoir Dogs. I don't understand how this works. And then I remember going into college for under the, you know, sort of guise of being a computer programmer, and then midway through I was like, I think I want to do something in entertainment. And my mom's, the look on her eyes, I'll never forget, she was just like, great, another one, because my brother's a set designer. So she was just like, we're gonna have to, she looked at my dad and she was like, we're gonna have to take care of ourselves when we get old. That's
gonna have to happen. I mean, the truth is, so I mean, it's like when I think about my parents, like they didn't know any, it's not like we had a friend that did anything like this, you know what I mean? My dad was a lawyer, my mom was a teacher, and their friends did the same. And I look, I'll be very honest with you. I graduated from college, you know, like on a Thursday, drove down to New York on a Friday, and then went back to work at Comedy Central on Monday. And that led to my first real job, which was at Saturday Night Live. And so I was never unemployed in the sense that I never had to like borrow money from my folks or have them go, what the F are you doing? You know, like, I don't understand this. And I've watched a couple of good writers I know who didn't quite find the quick success ultimately go back to like Wall Street and stuff. Guys I knew from college that were as funny as people I work with, but it didn't click. And at some point their own sort of life pressures just sort of sent them back to more traditional, you know, fields. But anyway, yeah.
I worked in pharmaceutical advertising for 8 years while I slaved away writing screenplays.
Wow. Night. So you guys have polar opposites there.
So see, but, that's what I'm talking about. Your podcast is bullshit.
See, Dave, I told you the school wasn't that good.
You guys, you lie right at the beginning of your podcast, right? Episode one, you're like, dreams don't come true, by the way. Blah, blah, blah. You want to shit all over everything. Look at you two living the dream.
For Ryan, what was that? What was that kind of good breaking moment for you? Do you have one moment where you're like, okay, this is going to be the thing for me, like this is going to work?
You know, I remember reading this story that a writer had written that said the overnight success 10 years in the making, and it was very much the same for me. It was like I had written I my parents also freaked out when they found out I wanted to be a screenwriter, and told me I had to go to college and get a real job. So I actually got an accounting degree of all things, and was, you know, sort of happily working. I joke about pharmaceutical advertising. It was actually a really enjoyable job. I was writing ad copy. I was a professional writer. I was having a good time, you know, and wanted to do the screenwriting thing. So I was doing that at night, but I wrote 13, you know, unloved, unproduced screenplays before. It was actually lucky number 13. That was the one that sold. And that one, I wrote it and it got me a manager on like a Monday, and then that Friday I had an agent, and then like on the following Monday I had an entertainment lawyer. Dave.
Ooh, an entertainment lawyer.
Tell me more. You, David, that could have been you.
on Tuesday it sold, so it was.
I would have gotten you such a better deal, but anyway.
I know. Yeah, you actually would have, and you know, so from that Monday to like the following Tuesday, like all the things that you need to fall into place, which happens usually for people over years or fits and starts, but it was for me, it was like, you know, 8 years of nothing, just writing. And then it all happened at once. The script sold. And then I got two studio jobs right away. And that was it. That was 2008. And I was off and running, haven't looked back, thankfully, you know, ever since.
When did Dwayne The Rock Johnson look at you and say, this guy gets to write all my movies?
Well, you know, that's a story to tell. No, I mean, it was really, you know, he came to Hercules. It sort of worked that way. So Hercules was a script I developed with MGM for something like 5 years before he ever got involved. And again, one of these overnight, you know, successes that took 5 years in the making. And I developed the script in many drafts. It kind of came and went and would get hot for a minute and go away and have a director attached and then go away. And then it was like, bam, 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 director got co-financed by Paramount and Dwayne came on all at once and attached himself to it. And then years later, I was working in TV with Carlton Cuse, who I created Colony with, and Carlton had written for New Line and Bo Flynn and Brad Peyton, the director, San Andreas. And they were in trouble on Rampage. So all that same group minus me was in trouble on Rampage. And they came to Carlton and said, hey, can you help? And he's like, I'm actually working with Hercules guy. And they did pretty well. So you know, Dwayne basically said yes. And then so Carlton and I ended up writing Rampage. So it was sort of a circuitous route, but you know, it's also hard to get a movie produced these days that, you know, doesn't have Dwayne in it. So
great point. It's a great point.
Very, very true.
Nick's been trying to get him in his movies for years.
Yeah, well, we're just trying to get him on a podcast. That I think we'd settle for that. That would be amazing. But so going just quickly back to Hercules, is that a movie that you were like, hey, I'm going to write this? Or was that something that they came to you and said, hey, we need you to do?
No, that was one of the first jobs that I got. I think that was the second or third studio, you know, kind of assignment that I got. It was an original based on a comic book called Hercules, the Thracian Wars. It was meant to be a really... kind of down and dirty practical take on, like, if Hercules was a real guy, what would it have been like? And it was very much like the Bill Hickok character in Deadwood, sort of this guy who's walking around carrying this legend behind him. He's a very good shot, but he you know, it wasn't magic. And that was the sort of idea behind it, was that, you know, Hercules, this real man, this incredible man that has this myth built up around him that ends up following him and haunting him, and people hate him or love him or want to be with him or want to kill him or whatever it is. So it was meant to be, you know, it was meant to be the grounded take on Hercules, and, you know, the movie became something else, as they all do, but that was the intent behind it. So that was a job I just got hired to do, and it's, you know, it stayed around. People, it was a great concept, obviously, really great concept. So it just hung around, and eventually one day it got made.
Dave, segueing back over to you. Your first big start, SNL. I guess Comedy Central, but SNL, that was how was the experience for you? What time period are we talking about, first off?
It was 92 to 95. So my first year was actually an election year, which is amazing.
And that's got to be great.
It was Dana Carvey just doing not only George Bush, but also
Rothbro,
if you remember.
Yeah, that. I remember.
And Phil Hartman doing Clinton. And it was incredible. And it was sort of, God. It was the tail end of those guys, and I guess the rise of Sandler, Farley, Spade, Schneider. So that was sort of that 92 to 95 period.
Incredible.
Do you look at the stuff they're doing now and just go, give me one more shot, I get back in there, I could do some
stuff? I've been lucky enough. I've had the chance to go back when we were in during Veep. Julia went back and hosted, because she was actually, you know, a cast member.
Oh yeah,
way, way back, and she's hosted a couple of times. So she hosted. And I went back with her and, you know, worked a little on the monologue and pitched ideas and whatever. And it was, I'm glad I'm not there full time, but boy, it's funny. Lauren himself actually says this. It's a little bit, sometimes when you go back, it's like you're going back to visit your old, like, high school, you know. It's like some of the people are still the same. Some of the teachers are there, but they're older. Everything seems smaller, but it's very familiar, even though it's like been many, many years, and yet the schedule's the same. Like it was very easy to just kind of slip back in. It was really fun.
That has to be, a lot of people say that's sort of the ultimate training ground for any other show after that.
It was incredible, because especially as a young writer, when you basically do a sketch on that show, you are the showrunner of your sketch, if that makes any sense. Everyone throws the word showrunner around, because you're really, you're talking to the departments. The director is directing cameras, but if there is actual like directing of actors, you're talking to actors about, they do it like this or whatever it is. So you're really like, you're in charge of your thing. And this is more on the TV side, but in Los Angeles, a young writer who goes to work on a first show, it's absolutely the opposite. You don't talk to the actors, don't go near anyone. You know, you'll be lucky if you're working on anything. And so when I did that for 3 years and then came out to LA, and at that point from my 3 years at SNL, I was a pretty good editor. I was, you know, it was like, I was mm-hmm. good at all of these things that even though I was working on I was working at Seinfeld. I remember, you know, like I remember being with Larry David editing an episode and he went to, I don't know, go deal with a phone call or something. And I kind of kept going and, you know, sort of did something without him. And he kind of came back and I was like, hey, I did this. And it was sort of like, oh, right, you were at SNL, you know how to edit. I mean, it was just, you know, it's an incredible training ground for all of those reasons. Well,
hero for SNL too, for like half a season, right? He
really hated it, but yeah.
that's, if I'm not mistaken, that's kind of how he had the connection with Julia, right? Or
yes, exactly. Yeah. They had worked together then and sort of, I think in the insanity of that year or whatever it was, they were sort of two people that had sort of like occasionally, like, we like each other. Like, I think you're funny. I'm not sure about any of these other people. And so when they needed a woman on Seinfeld, I think that's how that happened.
And then what's the Seinfeld connection for you? How do you get brought onto that project?
It's funny. Two guys that I wrote with a whole bunch went to work at Seinfeld. And so I used to visit there and I was sort of, it was fun because so many of the people, not just Larry, but Jerry had hosted and Carol Leifer had worked at Saturday Night Live. And so I was like the special lunch guest at the Seinfeld offices. And I was obsessed with the show and, you know, sick of SNL at some point, 3 years, it was like dog years. And it was just like, the opportunity sort of came where like Larry showed up at the final episode of SNL and was kind of like, you should submit some stuff. And it was just like, okay, great. And at that time, you know, Seinfeld, I mean, obviously people are still watching it, but I can't explain at the time just how revelatory and how different it was comedy wise from every other sitcom on TV. So it was the dream job. So yeah, that was kind of how I got in there.
That's fantastic. We got to have you guys back, because that's the thing is I think Nick especially could talk to you about your entertainment credits forever and ever and ever, whereas I'm more like, what props do you have?
We can do both.
Having a cool one.
Luckily we can all listen to you talk each and every week. You put out two episodes right now of The Stuff Dreams Are Made Of. It's available wherever your podcasts are found. Then it's going to go to a weekly schedule, correct?
Yes, every
Thursday for 12 episodes, is that the plan?
Yep. With a little break in between after the first six for the holidays. But yes.
Of course, yeah. Beautiful. All right, well, I hope you guys keep doing that. I really enjoyed it. Everybody should go listen to it. The Stuff Dreams Are Made Of. Follow at Props Podcast on Instagram. One day they will put up images.
No, today. Maybe even by now there's an image. thank you guys.
Thank you guys, please. Short.
I apologize. I am
Thank you so much,
Yeah,
guys.
Go do your thing, David. Right. For everybody else, remember, this is We Have Cool Friends. Each and every week we talk to our cool friends about the cool things they're doing. If you like that, go to patreon.com/kindoffunny where you can get every episode ad-free and ask questions for cool friends. The next cool friend is a gentleman named Rahul Kohli. Apparently, he was in something called Bly Manor and I, Zombie, but I've never heard of him in my entire life, so we'll see if he's got anything cool to say.
You'll like him. He has great hair.
Does he?
Yeah.
Is it better than mine?
Yeah, 100%.
God damn, I was hoping you would soften the blow a bit, Nick. You just laid it all out there.
It's very thick.
Oh, my goodness. Hair. Ryan, thank you so much for hanging out with us today.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
All right, until next time, everybody. It's been our pleasure to serve you.